Hail to thee, O Lady Precious Green, great river which gives rise to the cactus fruit, wind upon water, beauty upon shore, water goddess, giver of life, and subduer of the witch queen and eater of filth.
Brigid closed her eyes very slowly and opened them again. They're still there, she thought, with something between resignation and disgust. She lay in what felt and smelled like a hospital bed, in what, to her brief wakening glance, looked much like a hospital room, sterile, void of character as of contagion, much white and some chrome. Over her leaned a weird-looking old white coat, brown eyes huge behind bottle-bottom lenses. Behind him hovered an exceedingly earnest-looking young man. Both were light brown of skin and black of hair, although judging by the white wispy sidewalls on the older man's strange mushroom of a head, she suspected the blackness of the mass on top to be the result of art, not nature.
Where's Kane? And what's with that mo-wig?
The younger man looked completely at sea. The older man straightened, smiling.
We have gazed upon the very flames of your soul. We know that you were once Brigid Baptiste, senior archivist of the Barony of Cobaltville, and then brilliant researcher and brave operative of those who resist the tyranny of the barons. And now you're given new life, new power, new purpose, as Chalchi Wheatliquay, the Jade Skirt Goddess, Mistress of the Waters.
Sure. Now I'll ask again politely, once. Where is Kane?
He is no more.
Her green eyes flashed to the young man like lasers. Green wrath boiled up within her, frothing and ferocious. And more than wrath, a power both utterly familiar and totally strange. The young man's eyes bugged out of his handsome face. He hunched over himself, clutching at his sternum.
As I am the water that gave life to all things, as I gave rise to the ripe cactus fruit, which is the human heart, so can I send forth floods to devastate and end all life before them, and mine is the gift to stop the beating of the heart to which I once gave rise.
It occurred to Brigid, as the young man began to claw at the air, that she had spoken in a language she had never in her life so much as heard.
Please, mercy, goddess. Have mercy upon your devotees, who have joined your essence and aspect together with one worthy.
Brigid looked at him. For a moment, his outline shifted. He seemed a younger man, and then, almost for a moment, what? She had a glimpse, not before her eyes, but well behind, of a stocky jungle cat, deep russet orange and black, dappled with shadows of lush jungle growth. Then both were gone, and all she saw was a distraught old man in a laboratory coat and a ludicrous wig, begging for the life of his aide, which she, somehow, was in the process of taking.
Oh!
She looked back at the young man, now on his knees. His face was turning black and blue like a giant bruise, and he didn't seem to be breathing, although from the rolling of his now bloodshot eyes, he retained consciousness. I hope I can stop that, she thought. As she formed the intent, it was as if an invisible fist released his heart. The breath rushed back into his body, the blood back to his face, and he fell forward onto his hands.
I have no idea on earth how I did that. And I'm sorry. For now. However, I am going to ask some questions, and if I don't receive prompt and satisfactory answers, we may just have to start all over again.
I thank you for your mercy, Chachi Wheatliquay.
Thank Brigid Baptiste. Lady Precious Green would have had your life and that of your young friend for your impertinence.
Whoa, she thought. And where did that come from? Yet she knew it was true. The older man steepled fingers before his chest and bowed reverently. Then he turned and stooped to help his assistant to his feet.
Are you all right, Ernesto?
I'm fine, Dr. Marroquin.
Brigid could plainly see that that claim was a brave lie. The young man looked at her, and somewhat to her surprise, she saw in his mild brown eyes neither anger nor resentment, only something she feared as worship. He made praying hands and bowed as well.
Forgive my presumption, Lady of the Jade Skirt, and thank you for your mercy.
What's happened to me?
Ernesto blinked uncertainly at Dr. Marroquin.
All will be explained to you in the fullness of time, Lady.
I meant after I materialized in your lab.
Ah, you were stunned by some of our security men. a regrettable necessity. But among other things, your powers of healing have been remarkably augmented. Although in truth, you should feel no lingering ill effects from your stunning.
She sat up. As she did, she felt the kiss of cool air on her back. Bear, all right. It felt good, but gave her a flash of annoyance. Why did they ever come up with such a foolish design in the first place? And why did they keep it? Do they think degradation is therapeutic? She noticed the two men looking a little green around the edges again, realized she had to have been frowning. Then her vision did a brief whirl, and she swayed. The young man named Ernesto was instantly at her side, holding her up, again a pretty ballsy act, considering. She smiled at him.
Lady, you must not overexert yourself. You have been through much, and to take your aspect upon you so soon, before you've had a chance to recover.
Your powers are great, Lady Precious Green. Yet even a goddess has limitations. Please, move slowly until you have begun to perceive them.
I appreciate your concern, Dr. Marroquin. And yours, Ernesto. You can take your hand back now.
He did, hurriedly.
At the same time, something has been done to me that I do not understand, and to which I most assuredly did not consent. That does not make me happy, no matter what powers the procedure may have conferred on me. And I came here, in possibly not the best conceived act I've undertaken in my life, for one purpose, to find my soul friend, the man named Cain, and bring him home. So now, even before you make a full and convincing explanation, not just of what it is you've done to me, but what the hell gave you the idea it was all right to do so without my permission, you will take me to Cain, or bring him to me. Or I'll start to explore my shiny new powers in a way you will not like.
Dr. Marroquin never flinched. Instead, he smiled thinly.
I believe your wish is granted.
Lying on the door, indeed riding it into the room's middle in the manner of a surfboard, albeit lying on his back, waving limbs in the air like an upset scarab, came a man. It was not Cain, although Bridget's first terrified thought upon beholding him was, Mag. But he wasn't. Despite the fact that it was cast of gold polycarbonate and not the gleaming sinister black of a hard contact suit, nor did it cover his whole body, his armor and helmet were more than slightly reminiscent of what the Baron's enforcers wore when their hybrid masters felt the need to impose some serious fear upon their subjects. A device was painted upon his breastplate in blue, a curious stylized, streamlined creature with a long tongue unfolding from gaping jaws and a long feather or crest extending backward from the head, ending in a sort of upward curlicue. He was shorter and stockier than Cain, but his upper arms and thighs, left bare by his curious armor, were molded thick with muscle. The sliding door came to rest with a thud against the base of Bridget's bed. So did the top of the man's gold-helmeted head. He went limp, momentarily stunned, and Bridget stared. Not even Grant, the strongest non-mutant man she knew, could have thrown a man that size through a door like that.
Cain!
The man who stood framed in the doorway's unaccustomed gape paused and regarded her with wolf-gray eyes. He was tall, wide of shoulder and chest, tapering like an arrowhead to his waist. His legs, bare beneath the gold-trimmed hem of his white linen robe, were twined with wiry quick-response muscle. His black hair, just brushed to the edge of perceptibility with gray, was swept back to hang to his nape. His beard had been trimmed to a black vertical bar descending from lower lip to the tip of his chin. Embroidered in gold, upon the breast of his gown, was a circular device representing a face or mask, open-mouthed and surrounded with curving, highly stylized rays. Its chin bore a bar not unlike Cain's beard. For a moment, he gazed at her without apparent recognition. Her heart threatened to collapse, but then a wild wolf light blazed up within them.
Baptiste!
He lunged for her and caught her in his iron-band arms as she sat on the bed.
Anamkara!
She hugged him as if she had been drowning in an infinite sea of time and space, and he was the one plank, the one speck of solidity she sought for her salvation. Which, of course, had been the case. He looked down at her. His eyes blazed like suns. Hers were bright, endless seas. Their faces almost touched. A guard appeared in the doorway.
My lord, Dr. Marroquin, forgive it, please. We tried our best, but could not stop him. What do we do now?
Stay back. Unless you want to learn what gods are like when they're really pissed.
As if by common impulse, Cain and Brigid pushed back from each other, although they continued to clutch each other's arms.
The goatee looks good on you, Cain.
Thanks.
There was much that was strange about this man with the golden sun mask on his chest and the power of the sun within. She could sense that as clearly as if she could see it or hear the infinite roar of the solar furnace. But she still knew him.
What took you so long?
Whatever's happened to you, you are still Cain.
She looked past him then, and her eyes widened. More armored men stood to either side of the doorway, peering cautiously in. In their golden gauntleted hands, each bore an object, which for all its unfamiliar detail was deadly familiar in design and origin.
Infrasound wands! Cain, they're hybrids!
He shook his head and laid a soothing finger on her lips. Under other circumstances, she might have tried to bite it. The impulse was absent for just this moment.
Look at them. They're much too sturdy for hybrids.
Then they're hybrid servants, baronial guards, or...
She stopped cold, because in the door, between the men, had appeared a young woman, dressed in pale gray trousers and a mauve blouse of some soft material, and she was unquestionably a hybrid. The most human-appearing hybrid Brigid had ever seen, except for the Baron she had encountered, and with her elfin, olive-hued features, inhumanly enormous brown eyes, with long black lashes, the black wisps of hair curling above a slight blush upon either cheek, she was strikingly beautiful. But Brigid's reaction was hard to suppress.
She's a hybrid, Cain.
The woman stopped in the act of entering the room. Her eyes flashed.
Yes, I am, Lady Precious Green. And all honor and respect to you. Please do not judge me before you come to know me.
Brigid blinked. It wasn't a thing most hybrids of her acquaintance would have ever thought to say. But this was clearly no normal hybrid. Indeed, it seemed as if the blood of the Tuatha-De-Danann expressed itself in her in near pure form, to the exclusion of the lizard-like Anunnaki or other genetic influences.
That seems a reasonable thing to ask. And whoever or whatever else I am now, I'm still a senior archivist, and reason is my life. So I'll certainly grant your wish and even apologize—
Please, great lady, no. Please do not apologize to one such as me.
Brigid looked up at Cain. He shrugged and flashed a lopsided grin, and was so much the Cain of old, she wanted to both laugh and cry. Instead, being the senior archivist that she was, she drew in a deep breath, squared her strong shoulders, and set the expression on her fine-boned face with a little unconscious flip of her red-gold hair. She looked to Dr. Maroquin and swung her legs over the side of the bed.
And now you will please us by providing both of us with the explanation I suspect you have been denying, Cain. But first, get me a decent garment to cover myself with.
New Edo.
There is nothing I can teach you about fighting, Mr. Grant.
Grant was facing a little Chinese guy that was sitting beneath a spray of wisteria, captured and held in a vase in an alcove. Grant looked as if he was about to step on him.
I can teach you about moving beyond mere fighting.
Mere fighting? What do you mean, mere fighting? That's like saying mere dying.
The man bowed.
Perhaps.
The little man didn't look like much. He appeared to weigh about 80 pounds, wispy white goatee and all, and was clearly an oldie, although he certainly seemed limber enough, and his eyes sparkled in his parchment-skinned face. He was apparently the real deal, though. He was flavor of the month with Shizuka's bannermen, despite their brash, and to Grant's mind somewhat insecure, insistence upon the superiority of their own fighting style and their reflexive mistrust of strangers. Palace gossip said he was actually from mainland China and had turned up in the islands on trading vessels a couple of times before. Grant stood. In his own light silk robe, he was an imposing figure, and subconsciously kept his head ducked to one side to prevent it encountering a roof beam. Most buildings in New Edo had not been constructed with a man of his imposing height in mind. He would have towered over Master Chen had the Chinese wanderer been standing. Now it felt to him as if he confronted a child. Still, it was a child who made strong claims, or allowed them to be made on his behalf, and who had just made a very specific claim that Grant found very specifically outrageous.
You're a martial arts master.
Chen sipped tea from a cup of deliberately rustic design. That sort of thing was currently the fashion in New Edo.
So I have been called.
But you dismiss mere fighting with contempt.
Not contempt at all, Mr. Grant, if you will forgive my contradiction. Such activities have their place under heaven. But it is assuredly an inferior one, and it seems an activity that you yourself value far more than its actual worth.
Grant found himself near hyperventilating. He forced his massive bellows of a chest to pump more deliberately, but his eyes were bloodshot and his nostrils splayed like a bull's. Suddenly the room came into ultra-clear focus. Pale buff mat beneath them, one whitewashed stone wall crisscrossed by dark wood beams, the rice paper shoji panels that made up the other walls. The little man was sitting imperturbably in the middle of it all, just radiating total superiority. Grant had come to the Shogun's sprawling palace with a chip on his shoulder. He was no fool, and he knew himself at least that well. He felt as if part of him had been amputated with Kane's disappearance, and the sense of powerlessness fostered by his actual inability to do anything about it ate at him like a cancer. He'd half hoped that the ever-fractious black dragons might get up to their merry pranks again, trying to undermine their scandalously female de facto shogun, Shizuka. But they puppied and were being placid, not making any kind of nuisance of themselves at all. Whether it was all the recent alarms and threats, or Shizuka's leadership in bringing the realm through them, they appeared sated with action for the time. And now it seemed to Grant he saw a safe outlet for the intolerable pressure of the frustration boiling inside him.
I'm tempted to show you a thing or two about real fighting, little man.
You must act as your nature dictates, Mr. Grant.
Grinning like a god of war, Grant struck. Grant came to rest, with the soles of his bare feet resting against the whitewashed stone wall, his back pressed against it, and his neck bent so that his massive chin rested on his clavicle, helping to buttress his considerable mass.
I humbly beg forgiveness for doubting your mastery, master.
Freely given, but unneeded, my friend. For were I not your master, even at mere fighting, what then might I have to teach you? It was simply prudence to assure you on that score. Will you take tea?
No.
The door slid open. Kneeling, one of Shizuka's servant women bowed in the opening, her face painted white and hands hidden within the enormous sleeves of her green silk kimono.
Grandson, my mistress bids me tell you that a call has come for you from your homeland.
Grant looked decidedly uncomfortable, still in his inverted position against the wall, now in the presence of the servant woman.
Now, do I have to kill her to save face?
It would be inadvisable to try. They all carry darts in their hair in lieu of pins, and they are skilled in their use.
I know.
The woman waited, head lowered so that her eyes did not meet Grant's.
I'm not answering. Tell them I'm out or something. I'm resting. I like sitting like this.
But they say it is most urgent.
Same answer.
Her head raised slightly. The almond eyes flicked toward him.
But they say they have found your friend.
Grant sprang away from the wall and landed on his feet facing it.
Later, Master. Thanks for the lesson.
Master Chen bowed.
How could that old hybrid be Quetzalcoatl?
Kane, Bridget, and Dr. Maroquin walked along a gallery within the giant rambling castle, or mansion, or whatever it was. Ernesto and Teresa followed at a respectful distance. On their right was a highly stylized mural, representing a long, gory, and fantastic series of events. Beneath their feet lay a catwalk made of what appeared to be bronze mesh, but was almost certainly plated steel. Below them, people moved slowly and spoke mutedly among lit displays and potted plants in a wider space that appeared to be some kind of museum or possibly meditation area. On the left, instead of a wall, was a huge window of smoked glass, giving a view over a great courtyard tiered with mighty blocks of stone and containing a fabulous garden of exuberant green tropical growth, elephant ears and orchids and lianas strung everywhere in profusion. Small monkeys scampered along the stems of huge leaves with yellow undersides ribbed in green. Lizards, great and small, crawled upon the stone blocks. A pair of globular eyes, belonging to what appeared to be a dwarf caiman or crocodile, protruded above the placid, murky water of a pond at the bottom of it all, with pale green algae, or perhaps tiny flowers, floating in a patch about them. Dragonflies, with bodies as long as the span of the outstretched fingers of a hand, drifted in the heavy air, their great wings shimmering.
About a century ago, when the cataclysmic Earth activity sparked by the Newcast was reaching its crescendo, a party of adventurers arrived here by a mysterious means. We know a great many things here today, not least of which is much of what goes on north of what was once the border. There are good reasons for this, which will also become clear to you shortly.
Good.
They came to the catwalk's end and into an area that might have been the waiting room for a suite of offices. Though the walls were white, the lighting was low, and much of it came from spotlights illuminating alcoves, showing various artifacts of apparently ritual nature. Masks of feathers, of clay, of beaten gold, weapons, shields, cloaks of cloth, and the ubiquitous brightly hued feathers. Some low, dark, leather-upholstered furniture was placed around the space, off which several somewhat better-lit corridors led. Kane looked at Bridget, as if she, as the archivist, should have the answers to the apparent incongruities. She shrugged. Dr. Maroquin led them across the space toward what appeared to be an elevator.
One party spoken of in documents from that time escaped from the stricken city, although grievously injured. She reached a cave in the mountains to the west, where she found shelter. There she made a remarkable discovery.
She?
Her name was Felicidad Mendoza. She was the lover of the ruler of the countryside surrounding the city, Don Hector, and daughter to his security chief, who was executed by Don Hector. She was in line to succeed her father before Don Hector was killed.
They reached the elevator door and entered when the door opened.
As to the next twist of the story, perhaps my associate Teresa would care to recount it?
Felicidad Mendoza discovered an artifact of great age and prodigious power. Most likely, it drew her to itself.
What, like the One Ring?
The dark-haired woman looked briefly blank. Unlike Bridget, she seemed to have no great acquaintance with pre-Skydark literature and popular culture. Maroquin pressed a button, and the elevator descended. Teresa continued her tale.
She was a woman of enormous potential in the use of prana. She had an affinity for it, a natural ability unknown to her, to tap into and control it. Perhaps she sensed that the artifact produced a prana homing beacon. Her very weakness, delirious with pain and likely fever from her injuries, and the stress of her escape from the city's final destruction, no doubt rendered her more receptive than she might otherwise have been. Her consciousness, her interfering self...
Her pervasive cynicism?
...was unable to block or explain away inputs received through senses she had not previously suspected she had. In short, it called. She came.
And what was it?
A great polished lens of obsidian, the smoking mirror.
An artifact created hundreds, possibly thousands, and indeed perhaps tens of thousands of years before, by an alien technology and alien hands. It derived from the folk known upon Earth as the Twaha de Danann. Although it was quite possibly either modified or actually made by their rivals, the Anunnaki.
He peered keenly from the face of one of his captive gods to the other.
I see you are surprised, but not confused. You know the reference.
And you're not surprised that we do.
No, Lady Chalchi Wheatlique. No, I am not.
Dr. Maroquin smiled. The elevator stopped, deep beneath the earth. Cerberus Control Center.
Where is he?
Good day to you too, Grant, my noble friend.
The big, great-chested black man stopped in the room's midst with feet apart, legs braced like mahogany trunks.
Don't make me shake it out of you, little man.
Kinda sorry I gave up the idea of tripping you.
Grant spun. He had charged right past the slim, slight form of Domi without even seeing her. She wore a camo halter top and khaki cargo shorts. It was about as dressed as she got in the climate-controlled warrens of Cerberus Redoubt.
Domi, where's Kane?
Peace, my friend. I will send you to his aid soon, almost at once, in fact. But I cannot permit you to go in blind. Calm yourself and listen, and I will tell all.
All? That'll be a change.
Grant folded his arms across his mighty chest and settled himself to hear.
They've got Bridget now, too, you know.
What? Damn, what is wrong with you people? First you lose Kane and now Baptiste?
It was scarcely our fault. She stole an interphaser.
Stole?
I had ordered them all secured precisely because I feared such an eventuality. She possessed herself of a unit and overrode the safety controls in a most rash, irresponsible manner. A protege of mine.
She jumped blind? Whoa. I always knew she had some big ones on her, even if she is a librarian.
Archivist.
When you said big ones, you meant like cojones, right? Because she has a pretty impressive set of...
Darlingest Domi, that will do.
Oh, that's right. I'm just a little gaudy slut, a slave to order around, just like Guana Teague.
Domi, shut the fuck up.
Thank you. She jumped blind. Collins, whom she threatened with a handgun in order to obtain the jump unit, said she acted strangely. I surmise she was sleepwalking, or perhaps more accurately, moving in a half-waking dream.
Whatever, it worked.
Hardly had we responded to the alarm the good Mr. Collins had raised at Bridget's, unauthorized requisition, than her biolink transponder indicated she had jumped to the northwestern quadrant of the urban concentration that has sprung up upon the site of the erstwhile Mexico City.
Mexico City? God damn. I knew she was right, all this time, and you wouldn't let me go.
Lakesh was unperturbed.
No, I wouldn't, because even had we known for an absolute fact that Kane was being held there, it's a city of over 100,000 people, covering many hectares, at least some of whose occupants, by virtue of the fact they sequestered friend Kane without his consent, appear hostile to us. To permit you to go would almost certainly have been futile at best, and likely resulted in our losing our other top field operative.
Your turn to pipe down now, Grant.
Domi, if you... Okay, you're right. You have the floor, Lakesh.
We know where Bridget was at the moment she contacted us.
You've lost her, too?
Nigel, the lead tech of the command center on that shift, spoke up.
Her biolink stopped sending within the hour.
That's impossible, isn't it?
Not at all. The biolink transponders send out a signal that, however slight, can be detected from orbit. Those signals can be detected, obviously, and the transponders can then be analyzed and neutralized.
Without killing the subject?
Yes, there are various ways.
So, we don't have to go around the planet with you able to spy on our every move?
We're hardly able to spy upon your every move, as you well know. And I dare say the transponder has served us and you well on more than one occasion. Without it, we would now be missing Bridget as well as Kane, and be little wiser than we were before.
So when do we go get him?
Soon.
And why not now?
It's daylight. This mission calls for sneaking and peeking. That's better at night. Come on, let's go pack.
It was a lens of black glass, 5 feet across, held in a frame of what might have been polished brass. Its surface was smooth, but not altogether regular, as if it had been pressure-flaked into shape and then polished. A few white inclusions, one as large as a palm, glowed like a nova on its surface. White vapor streamed off it.
The smoking mirror. In the ancient language Nahuatl, it is called Tezcatlipoca.
Kane and Bridget looked at each other. The artifact was kept in a vault deep beneath the Instituto Quetzalcoatl, in which they were immured as captive deities. The pair stood in an antechamber, with the white coat and his two helpers. It was cold enough to raise goosebumps on the North American's bare arms. Cold radiated from the slightly amber-tinted viewport like heat from a stove.
Inside that chamber is 40 degrees below zero Celsius. It is chilled by liquid helium. That is its optimal operating regime.
Even through thick insulated glass, They could feel the energy it gave off, more potent than the transferred chill. It stirred something within their souls, something not altogether comfortable. As though of one accord, they turned and looked down to find their hands linked. Hesitantly, they let go. Ernesto noticed nothing of this as he continued.
It is a high-temperature superconductor. Inset in the frame are squids to control and calibrate it.
Superconducting quantum interface devices.
You are familiar with the technology, Lady Precious Green?
I'm not actually your antique goddess. Although I have to admit I have memories and thoughts that are identifiably not my own, it is not a comfortable sensation.
It's not that, Ochalja Wheatlaque. We know you are by a vocation a librarian.
Archivist.
She has a photographic memory. The real woman has real memories of everything she's seen or experienced, not like the fake memories you stuffed her head with. Our heads. She specialized in researching the late 20th century. She's no white coat, but she's scanned a lot of technical journals. She can talk the talk.
How did you know that I was an archivist?
Marquine nodded toward the mirror.
That again?
The mirror allowed us to read your thoughts to a certain extent. It has many remarkable capabilities, which, to be candid, we have only begun to plumb in almost a century of study.
And they are not false memories, Lord Donatia.
Are you trying to tell me there was really such a person as Donatia?
There was such a person as Don Pedro de Alvarado, and the Aztecs did call him Tonatia. And he did preside over the mass murder of ringleaders of a rebellion that his own brutal misrule provoked during the absence of his own master, Cortez.
My dream. How did you...
She reached up to touch his scarred cheek.
I dreamed your dreams. How do you think I knew you needed me?
I see you have read Bernal Diaz del Castillo.
And Prescott.
You have most Catholic tastes.
It goes with the name.
What the hell have you done to us?
Marroquin smiled thinly.
Shall we repair to a slightly warmer venue?
All right. Tezcatlipoca means smoking mirror. Somehow I knew that before you said it.
The five of them sat in a break room in the vaults not far from the artifact's cold chamber. Several upholstered chairs surrounded a table, and there was a sofa nearby. Cain and Bridget sat beside each other on the sofa, not too close together. It was uncannily like something they might have found within Cerberus. Dr. Marroquin was perched in an auditorium-style chair, with legs crossed and hands clasped over one knee. His eyes were very bright.
But it was brought here by Quetzalcoatl, or built by him.
What makes you say that, Lord?
Cain looked to Bridget. She returned his gaze calmly. Her expression gave nothing away. I wish we could exchange thoughts someplace other than our dreams, he thought. Teresa, the beautiful hybrid, sat in a chair across from the seated so-called gods, while Ernesto hovered beside her. Dr. Marroquin just sat looking vaguely pleased and bland enough for Buddha.
On the moon, I was told that the original Quetzalcoatl was an Anunnaki named Lam, an alien.
It was now Teresa and Ernesto's turn to glance at each other.
You were told this by McCann of the Danann, were you not?
How did you know that?
The mirror.
Is there anything that object can't do?
It has, as we have said, remarkable capabilities. But please, put yourselves at ease. It enabled us to glean certain information from your memories that we deemed relevant to our mutual needs, yours and ours. The vast preponderance of both your memories are still private, which you may believe for no other reason than there are simply too many of them for us to assimilate, even if we had any desire to do so.
Bridget looked at Cain again. He shrugged.
Lam of the Anunnaki, as Quetzalcoatl, brought the smoking mirror. He initiated some of the brighter youths into a priesthood and taught them its uses. One of them, or their successors, might possibly have provided the historical original for the god Tezcatlipoca. Indeed, it's possible that the first Tezcatlipoca might have understood the mirror better than the one who brought it, especially if Lam stole or was given the artifact. Not even he may have fully grasped its potential.
Danann technology is like that. They seem to favor a strong intuitive component in learning and making use of it. Indeed, I have come to suspect that at its most potent levels, they themselves do not, fully comprehend it except through protracted meditation and exploration.
Cain noticed that Teresa, who didn't seem overly friendly to Bridget despite having helped turn her into a goddess, was listening with an expression of rapt intensity on her elfin, brown, not quite human features.
You show great understanding, Lady Chalchi Huitlique.
Thank you. But it seems to me you're still not telling us what we want to know, which is why you've kidnapped us, what you've done to us, and why.
Please, it's a most involved tale.
Then you'd better move it along, before your captive deities run out of patience.
Felicidad Mendoza did not die despite falling from the pyramid. She escaped, badly injured, to a cave in the mountains to the west.
Where she found the weird Danann toy you've got on ice in there.
Please, Lord Donatia, bear with us. She found something else there. She was imbued with the spirit of the goddess Coatlicue. The spirit's powers, perhaps in concert with those in the mirror, healed her.
Okay, I know I'm not supposed to interrupt, but you just lost me. You mean Quetzalcoatl wasn't the only Aztec god who was real? There really was a Tonatio? And Chalchihuitlicue? And why can I even pronounce that name?
Teresa, completely at a loss, glanced at Dr. Marroquin.
Please, my lord. One's personality, yours, mine, anyone's, is, among other things, a self-perpetuating system of electromagnetic energy. Your thoughts, in particular, are electrochemical in nature.
He paused meaningfully. After a look to make sure the floor was clear, Ernesto, leaning forward like a dog on his leash, jumped in.
As we've said, as you've seen from the size and power of the prana accumulation machines in this compound alone, this valley possesses unusual geomagnetic characteristics, possibly unique in the world. Historically, the geomagnetic flux has been substantial. Over the last couple of centuries, since the Nootcast, it has been enormous. Certain strong personality patterns have, in effect, become recorded in the very rocks and fault lines of the valley, and the geomagnetic flux can energize them, amplify them.
I'm still unclear as to how all these deities can have been real. We have learned that a great many legends are based on actual beings, often, of course, Anunnaki, Tuatha De Danann, and the hybrids who resulted from their having interbred to reinforce a truce. But there are a lot of gods in the Aztec pantheon alone, and there are a lot of pantheons. Are all the gods based on actual beings of greater than human powers?
Both Teresa and Ernesto looked as if they were bursting to respond, but Marroquin wagged a languid hand.
The shortest answer is simply not necessarily. For example, no evidence has survived to the present day that there was ever a single individual upon whom Chalchihuitlicue, the Lady of the Jade Skirt, was based. But keep in mind that a terrific number of archaeological and anthropological records were lost in the Nootcast and its aftermath, as were records of all kinds.
Brigid stared at him. Uncharacteristically, sweat stood out on her high, smooth forehead.
Then, who's in my head? I have thoughts that don't originate with me. They're in my mind, but they're not mine.
Cain had seldom seen her so distressed. Something struck the back of his neck. He reached back and felt moisture. On his fingers was what appeared to be water. Looking up, he saw a round, clear stalactite of water was stretching down from the acoustic tile overhead.
Looks as if your sprinkler system has a leak.
Brigid had reasserted control, but it was clearly as brittle as rime frost.
I've just been describing classic symptoms of schizophrenia, of course. Am I losing my mind?
Do you think so, O Lady Precious Green? Look down.
Droplets of water were falling from the ceiling now like light rain. As they struck the floor, they formed together in streams. The streams writhed toward Brigid's sandaled feet like transparent serpents, flowing together into a growing pool. Brigid looked up at Dr. Monopil, who had what appeared to be sweat sheening his whole face.
You are doing that. In reaction to your emotions, you are drawing water from the atmosphere and from our very bodies. If you persist, you will begin to seriously dehydrate us. So I request that you stop.
But how?
The power is yours, O Goddess. Command it.
She looked at him a moment more, closed her eyes, slightly frowned. The rain from the ceiling stopped. Dr. Marroquin took out a handkerchief and mopped his forehead beneath the unlikely line of his dark mound of hair.
Is anyone else thirsty?
I'll get us some water.
Teresa rose to draw water in paper cups from a cooler.
Thank you, my dear. Does that satisfy you, Lady Chalchihuitlicue, that you are not mad?
Not altogether. But if I am, it's one hell of a delusional system. The question remains, who's Chalchi Huitlicue? And don't try telling me she's me.
Thoughts are electrical, lady. Emotions are electric. Belief is an emotion. Rituals involving thousands of celebrants were held for many years in worship of Chalchi Huitlicue.
Involving, let us be candid, the sacrifice of many thousands of human lives, as indeed the worship of all the gods has, save Quetzalcoatl.
Brigid's green eyes were wide pools of confusion and near panic, but her years of archivist training and self-discipline helped her command herself to be calm, as she had commanded the waters to cease flowing to her.
So the Chalchi Huitlicue persona is an artifact. It has no necessary connection to any real person. It is, in effect, a recording of the fervent beliefs of thousands over years.
Strengthened, of course, by the release of the life energies of many humans. Victims.
Brigid stared at him.
And this is what you've turned me into?
Cain rubbed his chin. The skin to either side of the vertical bar goatee he had been left with had begun to bristle. He felt a curious fatigue beginning to creep over him.
The key question then becomes, can you reverse the process? For your sakes, the answer had better be yes.
But Lord Tonatiuh, think of what we've given you. The power. We have no idea where its limits lie. You are embarked upon an incredible voyage of exploration.
Which we did not volunteer for.
Which brings me to the question of why our friends have not yet attempted to mount a rescue.
Because, of course, they are uncertain of your present location. When we summoned the chosen vessel of the Lord Tonatiuh's persona to us, we drew him to a room shielded from electromagnetic emanations.
As you no doubt understand, both prana and the self-perpetuating system that constitutes the personality, while they have an electromagnetic component, are essentially quantum-level phenomena.
I understand that when we jump using matter transmission gateways, we are not broadcast like a radio signal, but rather translocate directly without crossing the intervening physical distance, like an electron jumping between energy levels.
The phenomenon the ancients called tunneling, to avoid the embarrassment of having to call it what it was, teleportation.
But shoveling aside all this happy white coat horseshit for just a moment here, Brigid materialized next to my bed, or wherever you keep me when I go out. Not inside your lead vault, or whatever the hell it was you used to block my transponder signal.
To be sure. But after stunning Brigid, and once again, I pray, permit me to express my sincerest regrets for such impertinence, we promptly conveyed her to an EM emission-sealed chamber to deactivate her biological transmitter. We also relieved you both of your communicators, which, like your other personal effects, are being safeguarded for you.
How about returning them to us right about now, and turning us loose to go home, before I fire up my solar flare dingus and start burning through walls, and any other extraneous material that happens to get in our way?
The three locals exchanged a look of trepidation.
You cannot, Lord Tonatiuh.
A barrier surrounds the valley, erected jointly by the gods and the others after reconstruction. It's a standing wave of probability. Anything physical that comes in contact with the barrier has not chaos, but true randomness introduced into each and every atom of its being.
Causing immediate disintegration.
I'm sure there are ways out of this valley. Whoever built this magical force field no doubt left a few back doors and secret exits. Anybody would do that. Plus, I do happen to remember that there were two operational Mattrans gateways in the valley at one time, including one in Mexico City that's not in the Cerberus database, much to Lakesh's distress. So I bet we can leave.
You must not leave, my lord and lady, for you will surely die.
Gods die? I thought immortality was part of the package.
As indeed it is. As we have told you, the personality patterns for our gods persist indefinitely, insofar as we know. Their fleshly envelopes, however, do not. Which is why Lord Quetzalcoatl is stricken, and why we need your assistance desperately enough to, yes, kidnap and transform you, mentally and spiritually, as well as physically, without seeking your permission.
Now tell us why leaving here would chill us. Preferably in words of one syllable that won't confuse and therefore piss off a real impatient sun god.
Teresa had regained control of herself, although spots of color glowed high on her thin cheeks.
As Dr. Marroquin says, we have transformed your bodies as well as your minds. That includes certain alterations to your metabolism. Your energy economy has changed, among other things, and markedly so. It operates on an altogether higher level than any unmodified humans. Unfortunately, we lack the skill to modify your bodies to support your accelerated metabolisms by themselves. Only artificial outside support can sustain you. You and the Lady of the Jade Skirt are unquestionably resourceful enough to find ways out of the valley and even back home. But then your bodies would eat you up from inside. Nor could the technological wizardry of your Dr. Singh save you. Not even the secret laboratories of the Barons possess the means to keep you alive.
Kane looked at her hard. He had a feeling that they hadn't even glimpsed this iceberg to the waterline yet. There was the whole issue of how these people knew so much about the baronies, yet had not been caught up in the reunification, the megalomaniacal power grab by the coterie of hybrids and human traitors that masked itself behind the title Archon Directorate. Nor what the hell an obvious hybrid was doing here in the first place. He noticed Baptiste was staring at Dr. Marroquin with a peculiar intensity in her emerald green eyes. The white coat's smile had become somewhat glassy, and he swayed slightly in his seat. If looks could kill, he thought. Then he realized that was precisely what was happening, or supposed to happen. Bridget shook her head as if flinging water droplets from her hair. And as a matter of fact, did. Kane felt a droplet splash his cheek.
I was chief artificer and theorist to the gods, Lady Chachi Huitlicue, even to Lord Quetzalcoatl before his exile a generation ago. Second only to the god Tezcatlipoca himself was my lore. And I haven't exactly lost ground since covertly stealing the mirror and fleeing to this district 2 years ago. So I beg your understanding that I did not fail to discern means of countering at least some of the divine powers, such as your attempt to stop my heart's beating with your gaze.
I allowed my anger to overcome me. That's not exactly like me. Especially since, from what you tell us, which I am forced, at least for the time being, to accept, killing you would do us no good. I was, frankly, overcome by a desire to slay you for your impertinence.
You realize that last sentence didn't come out in English, Baptiste, but some weird language I don't even know the name of. Which doesn't freak me out half so bad as the fact I understood every freaking word of it.
It is the knowledge that the god patterns have brought to your minds, my friends. As your response, milady, was not that of the supremely disciplined senior archivist Bridget Baptiste, but rather that of Chochi Huitlicue, the Lady of the Jade Skirt, a goddess, as is the case with most of our quaint deities, of death and life, and one who, despite a distinctly nurturing nature, has little patience with impertinence.
Why hasn't Tezcatlipoca noticed you stole his namesake?
Marroquin grinned. It took years off him.
I left a cunning counterfeit, almost as good as the real thing in many ways, and Tezcatlipoca pays little attention to it these days. He has other experimental devices to attract his interest.
Let's quit walking all around the muzzle and get down to the trigger of the blaster here. What do you want from us?
The power of the sibling gods Huitzilopochtli and Tezcatlipoca grows by bounds, as toss their lust for more. And for blood, human blood, shed at massive rituals of sacrifice, such as the one you saw on television, Lord.
Television?
Trust me. There's nothing good on here, either, just like they said in the pre-nuke cost days back home.
It is possible that their lust and their ambition threatens your friends north of what was once the border, and indeed the whole world. I would lie, and I think you would perceive it, if I stated that as surety. We really don't know what powers, if any, may be transferable beyond the unique geomagnetic environment of this valley, but the Smoking Mirror and Hummingbird upon the left are using their technology and their blood rituals to strengthen their powers, and those of the gods who follow them. First they will crush opposition within Tenochtitlan, then throughout the valley, and then, who knows, the divine mind is not notable for its ready acceptance of limitations.
What's in it for us, as individuals?
Why, Baptiste, that's real practical of you. We'll make a magistrate of you yet.
That's an even less attractive proposition than what these people have done to us.
To answer the lady's very pertinent question, I will first overlook what we have done for you already, which is, imbue you with abilities of amazing scope and potency. Understandably, you are still overwhelmed by the undeniable fact that our doing so without your leave was a violation. But laying that aside, if you help us defeat the monstrous plans of Huitzilopochtli and Tezcatlipoca and break the back of their domination, we will give you whatever lies in our power to provide, at your command and desire.
You want a couple of neophyte gods to destroy the greatest, most powerful, and presumably most experienced of gods? Would that sum it up?
Teresa shook her head, causing her little spring-shaped spit curls to lash her cheeks like the balls of a Chinese prayer drum.
Not destroy! Weaken! Help us restore Lord Quetzalcoatl to his rightful place and return balance to our valley.
Nor alone. There are other gods to help. Not all of the deities who rule the various colonias are enthralled with what you two are doing.
Brigid sat back into her cushion of the sofa, shaking her head.
This is far too confusing. And all these other people yammering at once in my head are not helping my comprehension.
We can get the ins and outs of local politics doled out to us in reasonable doses. Going up against actual gods, using the powers of gods, even half-trained beginner-type gods. Forgive me, Baptiste, but this sounds kind of like fun.
Dr. Maroki, please, you must dispatch the Lord Eleri at once. A terrible sepulchre has emerged from the lake, and he's devouring shoppers at the Kaloquad Mall.
Kane and Brigid hadn't realized there was an intercom speaker in the room.
Monsters at the mall?
Showtime!
The prospect of going mano a mano, or whatever the appropriate appendage is, with a surly 40-foot-long crocodile fish that had decided to turn a pre-nuke-cost-style shopping mall into its personal people-eating food court could intrigue a man, or even a god. So Kane was preoccupied.
Monsters at the mall? What's wrong with this picture?
Kane didn't answer at once. He could barely hear her over the noise of the helicopter's engine and rotors. The chopper was a trim little blue-and-white job. A stolid, stocky woman with receding forehead and jaw, dark brown skin, and raven's wing hair tied in a bun beneath her headset was at the controls.
For a rebel faction, these people sure don't act concerned about aerial interdiction.
Brigid nodded her head at the side window. It was something of a production, since she wore an unlikely contrivance of gold, jade, and green quetzal feathers. It was her equivalent of what Kane thought of as his own god hat. She also wore a skirt of leather tabs with jade plates fixed on them, and a scrap of muslin tied around her generous breasts. The outfit was supposed to be topless, an honor that Brigid had declined, on the basis it would make her feel too vulnerable in battle. While the strip provided at least psychological shoring up to the sometime archivist, it did nothing to conceal the fact that her nipples were standing up in excitement. Kane studiously kept his gaze from falling on them, even in passing. After all, she was just a comrade riding to battle with him.
We have an escort. They have their own equivalent of deathbirds, it seems. They seem to be based on the Aerospatiale Gazelle instead of the AH-64, the way ours are back home.
Kane leaned forward to peer out. Sure enough, he saw the distinct dragonfly shape of a helicopter gunship off their own port stub wing, a bristle with chin gun and what looked a lot like IR seeker head missiles.
Why don't they load it out with shrikes or the local equivalent and take out this crocofish from above with them and the chain gun?
Because they want their new gods to strut their stuff for the benefit of the public. This is about politics, you know.
Yeah.
The city unfolding below was jarring to both of them. They had never known a free, open city, sprawling and crawling with life and commerce, relative health and prosperity. And Tenochtitlan was all of these things. The ville in which both of them had been born, raised, and spent their adult lives was an artificial micro-environment, towers constrained within walls. Aside from a quickie time jaunt to old New York and a few brief semi-hallucinatory interludes in other casements, the only reference they had for a phenomenon like Tenochtitlan were vids and images from a time that was ashes and slag over 2 centuries before either was conceived. The cityscape beneath them was a strange mix of ancient myth and leading-edge technology. Steel and glass boxes next to stone step pyramids, surrounded by lush vegetation.
There's the lake!
Brigid pointed to a kidney-shaped patch of water glittering in waning sunlight, and the lights switching on in response to day's end. It was one of a handful of eruptions of the Great Lake Texcoco, which in the wake of the new cost had grown to cover an area greater than the present city.
Ernesto told me it subsided. The water table either sank or the land rose. Nobody seems to know. But apparently there's now an underground lake not much smaller than what existed a century ago.
Uh-huh.
Well, apparently none of the personality patterns you're playing host to is exactly loquacious, Kane.
None of us has anything much to say just now. Although I guess I can now say nothing in three different languages.
He leaned his head as close to the window on his side as his helmet would permit. He could have got closer by taking off the contrivance, of course. But it was such a pain in the ass to put back on. He wasn't sure what use it might be against a giant mythical lake monster. Then again, it afforded more protection than his skull.
How the hell did they manage to build all this in less than a century?
Most of the buildings in most of the cities in North America were less than a century old when the balloon went up. I guess it's actually easier and cheaper to build a city on top of a bunch of rubble than to replace an already built-up urban area piecemeal, which is what happened in places like New York and Chicago.
But these people had just undergone a brand new round of war and natural disaster. I didn't think it was possible to start out from less than zero, but they did.
Is it really that much different from what preceded the building of the Nine Baronies?
She had a strange expression on her face, a face he had to admit to himself once again that was more than just good-looking.
You think there might be some connection?
What do you think, Kane? We're shown an artifact of near-magical capabilities, not just Danann tech, but very possibly a blending of Danann art with Anunnaki craft. What do we call a blend of Anunnaki and Danann? And there's the girl. She's the most human hybrid I've seen. But she's a hybrid without question.
Kane glanced forward. Even if the pilot could overhear them, he had no idea whether she understood English. Plenty of people seemed to around here. But he decided he didn't give a shit if he were overheard or not. Who was the god here, anyway?
She's Mexican, as plainly as she's a hybrid. The Archon Directorate uses non-white, sure. Nobody'd accuse Grant of being a paleface. But then, we're all just animals to them. You get up to the highest levels, the ones hiding behind the Archon label, they're all lily-white and bone racists, human and hybrids alike.
Another mystery.
I hate mysteries.
These last couple of years must have been hell on you.
You have to ask? Speaking of Grant, how is he?
Fusing out with worry. He ran off to New Edo to sulk in Shizuka's tent when Lakesh wouldn't let him fly off blind in a manta to look for you.
Good old Grant.
He'll come for us, you know.
That's what I'm afraid of.
There's our Sepakli.
Kane moved to Brigid's side to peer out. He tried not to be aware of the amount of bare, pale skin her outfit showed, or the clean, unmistakably feminine scent of her. 100 yards below, the mall lay alongside the smallish extrusion of the ancient and mighty Texcoco. In fact, it straddled the lake by means of an arching footbridge, which had collapsed, no doubt under the weight of the giant scaly thing, now hauling its bulk up by means of club or fin-like forelimbs, onto a promenade which ran along the waterside. Its jaws, long as a tall man and chock full of long spiky teeth, menaced a young mother trying to dislodge her child from beneath the top of what looked like a table cast as one piece of concrete. The child was clinging to the central pedestal and bawling its head off. Meanwhile, Sekman in tan and green uniforms fired bravely, if unwisely, at the monster with revolvers. It ignored them. Whether it heard or felt the chopper, it didn't ignore that. It raised its snout to the sky.
You have got to be fucking kidding me.
Brigid swallowed, and her eyes stood out very slightly from the sockets, although otherwise she maintained iron control over her expression.
How exactly am I supposed to fight something like that?
Improvise. You're good at that. Think of it as on-the-job training in goddesshood.
She shot him an evil glare. He remembered then that her looks really could kill and glanced hurriedly away. The helicopter pilot did not exactly land the helicopter to let them off. She brought it down to hover barely a handspan off the pavement of the promenade, leaving the gods to jump down, clutching at their unlikely headdresses to hold them in place against the rotor wash. It was quite a skillful flying maneuver, really, although Kane was not disposed to appreciate it, being dumped like a grunt in a rice paddy in some vid of an ancient Asian war. Then the helicopter lifted off and flew away. Its gunship escort remained, orbiting 1,000 feet overhead, obviously to forestall any attempt by the forces that controlled the city to interfere, and just as obviously, leaving it to Tonatia and Chalchihuitlikwe to deal with the beast. Beside the promenade, there was a slight concrete embankment, and above that, the empty terrace of a restaurant. Beyond that were the windows of the restaurant itself, which were crowded with diners and onlookers. Some were jumping up and down with excitement. Cain drew his sword and used it to point.
Look, I think they're cheering for us.
Shouldn't I at least have a weapon?
The monster had noticed them now. The giant buzzing dragonfly that was the chopper had definitely drawn its attention. And it seemed more interested in these new arrivals than in the woman trying to pry her kid loose from the table. As it turned its unlovely head toward Cain and Bridget, a trio of intrepid sectmen ran out, grabbed the mom, yanked loose the kid, and ran them all back to at least relative and temporary safety. Behind the glass walls, the crowd went wild.
Use your godlike powers.
Cain tested the heft of his obsidian-bladed sword in his hand. It felt, well, inadequate. Indeed, not even the familiar reassuring burden on his right forearm was much reassurance.
But I'm a water goddess, and that's like being a fish.
So, give him your mean look.
I'm trying. Meanwhile, you'd better do something because it's headed this way.
It was lumbering toward them, land swimming with its blunt forelimbs, hauling more and more of its length out of the water. It was no more than 30 yards from them. They could smell an overpowering reek of fish, stale water, and other elements even less pleasant. Liquid drooled from its toothy lower jaw, possibly monster saliva, but tinged pink in a horribly suggestive way. Bridget winced and gagged at the fetor of its breath. Cain raised the shield strapped to his left arm. He sought for the bright lines within him and around him. He heard a leathery scuffling as the Sipakli dragged its tons of bulk toward them, and a sloshing of water as more of the thing emerged. It wasn't making it easy to concentrate.
Cain, do something!
She made no move to get behind him, he noticed. It was either as brave a thing as he'd encountered, or simply the fatalistic realization that those evil jaws were more than capacious enough to accommodate two gods at once. Fueled by pure adrenaline, Cain suddenly felt the fire of the sun. He tapped into the lines of flaming force that suddenly glowed alive in his mind like grabbing onto a power line. And to about the same effect, a jolt of incredible searing energy blasted through both pain and ecstasy at once. Blinding yellow radiance surrounded his sword as he sprang toward the monster. The Hellbeam could move at the speed of light, but the monster wasn't there when it struck. It had hurled its enormous mass back into the water with an even more enormous splash.
Impressive power there, Tonatia.
Bridget stared at the 2-yard crater with walls of white glowing glass that the blast had left in the pavement.
Son of a bitch moved. Did you see that? How did that sucker dodge light?
It probably sensed the potential energy building up inside you or around you. It may have an electrical sense, like a great white shark. But then even I could feel it, and I don't. Unless Chalchihuitlikwe does.
Cain stood staring at the murky green roil of water with its scum of brownish bubbles where the monster had disappeared.
That's some nasty-looking water they got in this lake. But look at what lives in it.
Maybe we scared it away.
Dream on. If we were that lucky, would we be here?
I'm glad you're here anyway. Thanks for coming.
She met his eye.
Anytime.
The lake erupted with hurtling death. Cain grabbed Bridget and dived with her to the side. The pavement buckled and crunched as tons of flesh and water slammed down upon them. The ground was still shaking when the two landed heavily scant yards from where the horror had struck. A wave rolled over them. Cain's flame blast had scared the hell out of it. That made it mad. Before, it had just been hungry. Now it was hungry and pissed. Its head turned from side to side. A big, round, mud-colored eye rolled angrily in its standout socket. Cain was reminded of alligator garfish in lakes and rivers up north. They looked something like this, and Outland's rumor had it that some of them had gone mutie, upward of 20 feet long, and not averse to making a meal of human meat. If you could trust what Dreg said, which as a rule you couldn't. But this thing wasn't like that. More gator and less fish. These thoughts flashed through Cain's head as he scrambled back to put some maneuvering room between him and all those teeth, each of which was as long as his hand from wrist to fingertips and a good deal sharper. He would have dragged Bridget with him, except she moved even quicker than he did, springing up to a low wall and crouching there, ready. The head turned toward him. He reached inside himself, found the glowing lines of force, and aimed the sword.
All right, buddy, your head's coming right off.
And then, nothing happened. Lots of nothing happened. Even the monster seemed to be waiting for something to happen. It might have been smarter than it looked, which wouldn't have been hard. It looked to have a brain box the size of a beer keg anyway. Or maybe it was another human in disguise somehow, like that frog monster. In any case, it hesitated, head kind of pulled up and back, staring at him. Kane aimed the sword again, called forth the very flame of the sun to incinerate the thing. But no incineration.
Shit! The water doused the new blasted flare!
The jaws gaped. A wall of practically visible stench struck him, staggering him. All those teeth homed right on him. A large wave hit the thing upside the head and rolled it right over on its back. Oddly enough, the wave moved right along parallel to the shoreline, unlike every other wave in Kane's experience. It still didn't seem natural. The monster wallowed and waggled its limbs in the air. Its bulgy belly was an unhealthy white, shading into an even less appealing yellow at the sides before becoming a mottled green and brown at its sides and back. It got its tail against the bottom, braced, and heaved to right itself. Another big wave smacked it back down.
Kane, do something! I'm running short of ideas here!
You're doing fine.
A third wave sloshed down upon the prostrate Saurian. Kane took quick stock of the situation. It sucked. He was sopping wet and his loincloth was all squelchy. The once splendid feathers of his helmet hung like wilted weeds above his brow. He knew without trying again that neither his solar flare nor his shield of the sun would be of any use. He did know enough science to know that what made the sun hot wasn't fire at all, but fusion, and that all the glowing gas he was tossing around was basically plasma, probably superheated air. But fire or not, his power didn't seem to like the wet. But his sword was still nice and sharp, sharper than any steel alloy, any kind of metal at all, they said. So he gathered himself and jumped on the monster's belly.